I'm Greg. I'm an alcoholic. Yeah, I have to thank Bill for inviting me to come and speak tonight. It's an honor. I think this is a beautiful thing that's going on here, this meeting. It's kind of making a record of AA here in our Tulare County community. So it's a beautiful thing. I hope we have the recordings around, although maybe you can delete this one later. That's Bill's job, huh? All right. You know, there was a couple of speakers when I was in early sobriety that said a couple of things to start off their pitches that kind of confused me and I didn't understand, and now I understand what they were talking about. And one of them said that he was very enthusiastic about this program, and I have to say that I am, and I'm grateful. This might sound kind of creepy to some of you that are kind of new, but I'm grateful to have been an alcoholic, or I don't think I would have been introduced to this way of life. And something else that another speaker said at a meeting, a man I admired, where I got sober down in the Laguna Beach area, that this is a spiritual program, and I didn't understand that either, you know. And over the years, it's meant more and more to me. I'll talk more about that a little bit later. But I grew up in Minnesota, and a western suburb of Minneapolis called Minnetonka. And I loved it there. It was great living amongst all those lakes and having the four seasons and playing hockey on the lake and snowmobiling, skiing, water skiing in the summer. And you know, I started drinking in my teens. I suppose my folks used to let us have a little bit of wine, you know, it's like the holidays, kind of on a heavy, you know, stomach that had already been weighted down, though. And later on, I found out if you wanted to get a good buzz going, you probably didn't want to eat your dinner or your lunch or whatever, you know, or just set that aside for later. So, and I never really felt any effects from that, but there was a Christmas party one year where we had we invited the neighbors over, and my dad started drinking again, and there's alcoholism in my family. My dad's an alcoholic. My grandfather, my mom's father, was an alcoholic and a bootlegger, actually, in the 30s. And so there's a long history of alcoholism in my family. But that particular Christmas, my dad was a little too drunk to be bartender, and so he showed me how to make the drinks, and I made a few for myself. And, you know, they were, has anybody ever had a Tom and Jerry? You know, kind of a nice, creamy, warm drink, you know, just kind of warms you up, makes you tingle, and gives you a good buzz, and I thoroughly enjoyed that. Another time, about that time, probably within a year or two of that, I was fortunate enough to be on a athletic team, a high school athletic team that won the state championship, and they got a keg afterwards. And I think I had about four beers, and I was trying to sell everybody on the idea of how wonderful, you know, this stuff was. And have you had some of this, you know? This is incredible. You know, I remember trying to convince one guy. I'm sure he never turned into an alcoholic. He just resisted and resisted and just would not. His arms were folded, and he just stood around watching the rest of us get drunk. But my parents, I think, had an inkling of what happened that night. Some of the older swim team fellows drove me home, and I got in a little late. And anyway, there was to be a lot of problems in our house. My dad had started drinking after being a dry drunk for many years, and then I started drinking, and there was fist fights and lots of fun in the household. You know, there was always something, though. I was looking for something when I was a kid, something to fill me up, make me feel better, make me feel a part of. And to some degree, I found that in food. I had a natural talent for swimming, and I did very well at that. And I had coaches tell me I could perhaps make it to the Olympics, or do very well, get a nice college scholarship. And I didn't listen to those coaches real well, though. But that was a huge desire for me, the swimming. It made me feel important, you know. It made me feel kind of a part of. There was something going on there, and it came time later on. Let me tell you one thing about that, though, first, with the swimming. I had, you know, these dreams of going to the Olympics, and I read about teams out here in California and Florida, and one in specific was down in Mission Viejo Matadors. And they were the team with a bunch of Olympians. You know, every time the Olympics came up, they had a handful of people going to the Olympics from that team. And I knew a girl that went out and trained with them, and she came back, and she was, what happened? You know, what was it like? Who were these people, you know? And I was amazed with that. And during the high school years, I drank quite a bit on weekends, and not much during the athletic season, though. But then college came along, and it was nice to get away from mom and dad, be 600 miles away from home and not have to worry about them checking up on me, getting dropped off by my friends drunk some night, you know, too early. I couldn't go into the house because I was wasted, you know, so I'd, I don't know, take a nap in the backyard or one night I tried to break into a boat on the lake that I assumed was a big boat, probably had a liquor bar in there, you know, and some alarm went off, and that was very stressful. Didn't get caught by the police or anything. I was lying in the grass about 100 feet away from this boat, you know, waiting for the police to come or something. Finally, the alarm went off. But eventually, I did swim well enough and restrained my drinking enough to get a college scholarship. And I went down to Springfield, Missouri, and I had every intention of getting my act together and not drinking. And the first thing that happened the day I got there, my dad dropped me off, and the swim team came out and unloaded all my stuff into the dorm. And he left, and they said, hey, want to go over to the KA house across the street there and get a beer? And I left there drunk, falling off a car about an hour and a half later, and I majored in drinking in college. So that's the way it was. I flunked out of that college three times because of my drinking. I was on the chug team, the fraternity chug team, and I drank the last beer that won the championship, you know? So I was very proud of that. It was important to fit in there, you know, and I didn't have a lot of money, so at fraternity parties, I worked the bar, because you drank free if you worked the bar. Sometimes they're a little worried about me making change and, you know, what they're doing, and I was always checking to make sure, you know, I'd open up the cooler to make sure we weren't running out of beer, shaking the keg a little, you know, and alerting, we're running out of beer, you know, you want to go get another keg. But that was, you know, I made a choice there. That dream, that Olympic dream, that swimming dream of, you know, just spending a year there and getting everything back under control and moving on to a big school, you know, like maybe where Mark Spitz swam. That was my goal, and it didn't happen. In fact, I quit the swim team. And like I said, I majored in drinking, and I didn't show up for classes. I loved being a part of that fraternity, though. It made me feel a part of. And there was a lot of drunks in that fraternity. And we enjoyed drinking and drinking and drinking. And I was, you know, my parents, though, showed up unexpectedly. Thank God I had a B on a test. I don't know how I achieved that. It must have been by accident. But they came into town and left. And you know, like I said, I flunked out of that school three times. I went back to Minneapolis, and I went into broadcasting to be a rock and roll disc jockey, and that didn't happen. I was living in a slum apartment in downtown Minneapolis on the third floor with a bunch of other alcoholics in that building, too, and I'd walk home at night having to step over Indians, drunk Indians. There was a lot of Native Americans living in that area, and a lot of them drinkers. And this was, you know, this place, I lived on Park Avenue in Minneapolis, but this was not a respectable Park Avenue. It was probably in the 30s, maybe through the 40s, but after that it started to decline. I moved back out to California. I moved to California. You know, everywhere I went, I made all these geographics, these moves, to try to get away from drinking buddies and to make for a better life, to stop drinking, to get healthy. And it's everywhere I went, you know, around the state here, back to Minnesota, then out here again. You know, I was carrying my disease with me everywhere I went. And it wasn't getting, it wasn't fun anymore. I mean, there was fun times back in Minnesota. We used to take the boat out on the lake. There was bars on the lake. You could take the boat out at night on the lake, you know, and hit some of the bars. And God, one night the steering wheel broke off the boat, and that was a hilarious evening. In 1987, I moved back to Minnesota, and I had friends that were getting college degrees, getting married, having kids, buying a house, and I was barely holding down a part-time job at a supermarket, and I lost that because of my attitude and some other things I did there. Couldn't show up for work on time because I was too hungover. And I went into the painting business. I was an unlicensed painting contractor for about 6 months. Made some decent money. But one drunk night, my dad called. I hadn't talked to him in 3 years. He was still out in California, and he caught me in a weak position. And he said, you know, how would you like to come out here and start over? And he had been sober. I found out that he had been sober for about a year and a half, 2 years by then. And I came out to California, took advantage of his plane ticket, and I came with everything I owned. I had a, cost a lot of money, too, to ship a TV and a VCR and my clothes. And that's all I had. And I moved in with my sister, and I continued drinking. In fact, I got a job with a painting crew drunk one afternoon, just calling painting contractors on the phone. And a little while later, I met a gal that lived across the way. Not some of you know, I'm married to a beautiful lady in the program named Christina. It wasn't her. It was another lady. I met her. She lived across the way from us in the apartment complex. And she indirectly brought me to the program. She was trying to get sober off and on, and it wasn't working out. And I hadn't had a relationship that lasted more than maybe a week or two until she came along. And we didn't drink together, except maybe a couple nights over 3 months. And we just hid it from each other, and it was a very dishonest relationship. But they hauled her off to a place in North Palm Springs one night called Lost Heads Ranch. And her family did. And a few days later, she called me and wanted me to come and get her. And I was watching Monday Night Football, and I was pretty drunk. And I got in this borrowed pickup truck and drove from Orange County all the way out to North Palm Springs drunk to go to this recovery place to pick her up. And when I got there, they talked me out of picking her up. And so I drove all the way back drunk. Didn't get picked up, luckily. You know, the chances we take, you know, and the lives we could screw up, especially out there on the road, it's crazy stuff. But I came back, and I was writing her letters all the time, and I started looking at my drinking, and And she said, you know, maybe you have this too. And I didn't drink for 5 days, and I didn't go into an immediate detox. I was living with a roommate. I moved up to Boyetta Park from Laguna Niguel, and I was living with a roommate I had in college who was the Anheuser-Busch rep in college. And so the beer flowed pretty well there, too, despite him not working. He was working for Hughes Aircraft then, but he had somehow managed to get through school. I think it took him 5 years, though. But that was, I think, about the time Michelob Ice or Michelob Dry or something came out, and he said, you got to try this, you know? And I said, you know, I hadn't drank for 2 or 3 days. I said, you know, if I drink one of those, I want to drink the whole case, you know? I had an understanding at that time of my drinking. I hadn't been to a meeting yet, but that young lady I'd been dating called one day. I wrote her a letter telling her I think I might have an issue with alcohol, and she invited me to a meeting out there. So I went back out to this place. You know, the first time I went out there, too, when I drove up, there was people standing under, it was at night, and there was like this giant carport, maybe the size of this room, you know, this covering. You know, pretty hot out in the desert, and they were standing around in a circle holding hands, and I looked at them and I thought, this is a cult, you know. And that when I know what they were doing now, right? They were doing the prayer at the end of the meeting. But I went to a meeting up there. It was a daytime meeting, and I was there to save this relationship, you know, that I had with this young lady, and that was not her intention at all. In fact, she had met some fellow there, but she was 12-stepping me, as she told me later. And I heard this guy came, he had, it was kind of like out of a movie. He walked up to the podium with, like, spurs on his boots, clicking and spinning, and, you know, and he's about my age, and he walked up, and he told my story. He told my story from, you know, like the last couple of years and the experiences I had with old drinking buddies and people just want me around to party with and, you know, didn't want me around for those special moments in their lives, just to be around and drink. And I had kind of a, I don't know, want to call it a white light experience there like Bill had or one of our founders, but I had this very major change in my thinking. And there was some lady too that was talking about the big book, and I kept saying, how big is this thing, you know? I expected somebody to drive around the corner with a forklift and drop it, you know, and two people to turn pages, and I had strange ideas, you know, to start off with. And after the meeting, I was just all shook up. I went in there pretty confident, you know, and I was a mess when I was leaving. Now I had to drive all the way, because I wasn't drunk, but I had to drive all the way back to Orange County again. And I heard something about sponsorship in the meeting, and I asked my girlfriend to sponsor me, and she declined. And she said I needed to find a man to sponsor me, somebody with some time, and I didn't understand what that meant at that time. And I left there, and I drove back to Orange County. And I sat in that apartment. I was trying to start a painting business again. And I was going through a lot of, I guess I was detoxing then. I was going through these big emotional mood swings. And I'd be sweating, and what is that horrible smell? You know, and it was me. It was me detoxing. And I was about ready to jump off the balcony in this apartment I was living in, but it was only one story up. So wouldn't have done much damage, you know. So I contemplated that for a few seconds, and no, that's not going to work. I didn't drink, though, and I called the central office in Orange County, and this lady picked up the phone, and this is Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and I said, you know, I went to this meeting, and I guess I need to go to more, or what do I do now? And she said, honey, you just got to keep going to meetings, you know, and she gave me a meeting to go to, and it was at the 502 Club in Fullerton. Well, that's, I think that was the name of it. I think that was the address, actually. But I drove past this place several times, you know, looking, trying to look in the windows and see what was going on in there, and it looked like a couple of guys that had just gotten back from Vietnam sitting around in fatigues talking, and I don't know, it didn't work for me. So I called my dad, I knew he was in the program. This very humbling moment, you know. Call your dad, somebody you hadn't gotten along with really most of your life. I called my mom first, though, you know. She called my dad, and he came and 12-stepped me. Now, that's really working your first step, really admitting you're powerless. You know, when your dad has to come and buy you your first big book and take you to your second meeting, and I slept on their couch. It was Christmas time. I got sober in late November. It was Christmas time, and my grandma was there, and there was a lot of whispering going on, you know. Are they going to a meeting tonight, you know? What are they doing? And I felt like an invalid there, detoxing on the couch. And I started going to meetings, though, and after a couple of weeks, I went to a meeting at the Canyon Club in Laguna, and I left there feeling good. You know what it was I identified with the people at the meeting. It was a young group from Huntington Beach. I was 26 at the time, and they were about my age or a little older. And I left there just feeling incredible, and I didn't know what that was about. You know, now I know it's a spiritual life, you know. It's relating to others. And so I started going to meetings on my own, and down there was a lot of young people's groups, or groups that had a lot of young people in them, from their teens to 30 or so. You know, some meetings were about 40% to 70% younger people, and it was great for me. I plugged in with these people, I got to know them, but for a while, the first month, all I was doing was standing up and identifying as a newcomer, and then I wasn't doing that anymore. And I was just sitting in the back of the meeting, you know, wondering why nobody was talking to me. And then when somebody would approach me, I'd be, you know, what do I say to this guy? You know, and I thought people were following me. I saw you at that other meeting last week, you know, why are you here? What's going on, you know? I didn't understand people went to a lot of meetings. I got tired, though, of not being a part of anymore. I felt a part of when I was identifying as a newcomer. And they made you stand up in meetings there, too, speaker meetings. You would stand up and tell everybody you were an alcoholic. And so this lady at the speaker meeting, much like this, she kept saying, she was the secretary, and she kept saying every week, you know, we get here at this certain time, and we set up the meeting at 6, and then we go have pizza and hang out together, and we come back, and we have the meeting at 8. And I thought, after a couple weeks of feeling really distant from my fellow alcoholics, I showed up. It was hard. I was scared to death. And they welcomed me. Some people knew my name, and they put me to work right away, so I had something to do. Later, I would be secretary of that meeting. I would tape that meeting for 12 years. I've been around a lot of speaker meetings down there. There's a ton of them in Southern California. And that allowed me to be of service in a large meeting. Some of the meetings down there are 150, 200 people, so... I'm not the type of person that would go to a meeting that big normally if I didn't have something to do to keep me busy. You know, I had tapes to set up, much like you guys got here, and the sound system, and people that were picking up orders, and that kept me busy, and I did that at several meetings, and I did service work like answering phones at the central office, and I was the cookie lady at one meeting, and you know, I got into service, and I believe solidly in sponsorship. I've been through many sponsors. Jim is here tonight. He's been an incredible force in my life as my sponsor here in Visalia. I've had a new sponsor wherever I go, wherever I move to. I've decided to have a local, and I hope to be here for quite a while. You know? Just to kind of summarize where I've come from, you know, there's been a lot of hard work. And I've done as good as best I can practicing the principles of our 12 step sevens in all of our affairs and working with sponsors. And sometimes I didn't do some of those things so well to begin with. I made an honest attempt or semi-honest attempt, and I went back later and improved that. I'm amazed at what this program, what people like you have been able to do with me. You know, coming in here, flunking out of school three times. I went back to college and got a degree. I don't know how that happened. I was scared to death the whole way going through that, thinking, you know, the shoe's going to drop now. This isn't going to happen. You know, I got sober in my mid-20s, and I was single pretty much, except maybe a week or two here and there for 10 years. People were starting to talk, you know. And I met my wife on this program. And in fact, Christmas Day, 1999, I was at the Canyon Club, that club where I first connected. I was recording a speaker meeting there at that time, and she happened to come in. I had seen this lady for years come into meetings, and I was always fascinated with her, but I usually stuck my foot in my mouth whenever she was around, so I couldn't bring myself to speak to her. But that night I did, and I got her phone number. In fact, neither of us had a pen, and she wanted to buy a tape for me. She's not here. She had something else to do tonight, but she doesn't like me to tell the story, but I'm going to tell it anyway. She wanted to buy a tape, and, you know, there's this guy standing there, and I wanted to ask for her phone number, and he wouldn't go away. And after the meeting, she said, you know, I'd like to get that tape, but I don't have any money, you know, or you're going up the road here. I could get some at the ATM. And I was like, okay, yeah, I'll go to the ATM with you. And when we got there, I said, and I had a friend in the program say this, you know, if you're scared to ask ladies out, just say, are you available for dating? Okay? It gives them an out. Gives them an out, guys. Okay? So I used that line on her, and she looked at me kind of funny, and she said, yeah, okay. And we couldn't find a pen. You know, I couldn't get... So I wrote her phone number in the dirty window on the side of my truck. And all the way home, I was hoping it wasn't going to rain or something, you know. And I got in the house, and I got that pen out, and wrote that number down. And I waited a couple days. You know, I didn't want to seem too eager. And I called her, and our first date was New Year's Eve, Y2K, 1999. And I was sick. But I didn't cancel. I wasn't going to cancel on this lady, you know. And a year later, on New Year's Eve, I asked her to marry me. And a year after that, we got married on New Year's Eve, you know, with a bunch of AA people there, my sponsor, and other close friends. And we've had a beautiful life together. You know, we've been through some trying times. This year, my wife's... sponsor and really, it's really like her real mom died, and that was a big loss for her. And I become a teacher. Amazingly, I'm shocked, you know, that the state of California would give me a teaching credential with my background, but they did. And I have a great job today, you know, and on the way to getting that job, and I better close here shortly, but on the way to getting that job, something, one of those really beautiful spiritual things happened, you know. Remember I was telling you about wanting to go to the Olympics and, you know, swim for, I didn't go to the Olympics, but swim for a really good team, and that was my childhood and teen dream, you know. And one of those teams was out in Mission Viejo, and through trying to get a teaching job, I said, you know what, I'll go into coaching. I'll have that on my resume, and I dropped by Mission Viejo High School and told them I was willing to be a swim coach if they needed one or whatever else they'd like to do with me. And I ended up coaching at that school where all these Olympians had gone to school. And I was asked after that to become a coach for the Mission Viejo Nadadors, the team that still is generating Olympians today. We were moving, though, so that wasn't possible. But that really brought tears to my eyes. And I did that. I was kind of a walk-on coach. And at the end of the season, those people, I wasn't expecting it at all. Handed me a check for $500. They knew I was, a substitute teacher, and we were living on some tight money. But I didn't expect that at all. And there's been so many things that have happened here that I didn't expect and I didn't think, would be the way I want my life to be. Just briefly, these days I am working on the character defect of negative thinking, and it's hard. But our steps, are very simple, but they're very difficult in some ways to work, but we just do them to the best of our ability. At least that's the way I've worked through it, and when the pain comes, that for me has been an indicator that I need to work on something else. And again, I want to thank Bill and all of you for listening tonight. This isn't my forte speaking, but I owe a lot to Alcoholics Anonymous. I owe my life to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm grateful to be a sober alcoholic and a member of the fellowship in this area. Thank you.